Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC, on the transformation of companies and their culture, from decision makers for decision makers, or from entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs.
So hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Leading Corporate Transformation, a WHU podcast powered by PwC. Today, we are in Frankfurt. My name is Serdan Özcan. I'm your co-host. As always, I'm joined by PwC's Gori. Hi, Gori. How's it going?
Zen, thank you. Thank you very much. It's going very well. Happy to be here and also warm welcome from my side. So my name is Gori von Hirschhausen. I'm the co-host of this podcast, as hopefully most of you know, and I'm the corporate transformation guy in this round. But at the same time, and that's why I'm very happy and proud that we have this talk today, is that I'm just recently became the EMEA private business leader of PwC. So I love this sector we will speak about today, because let me introduce our guest. It's a great honor, actually, to introduce Jan-Philipp Schmitz. His role is Executive Vice President, but to put it into context, he is one of the five people in the general management team of Adyen. He's also a member of the Executive Committee. He's the head of Adyen Germany and Asia. He's the head of Investor Relations and also holds senior management role in the primaries and secondaries. So he's all over the place. And that's good to speak with Jan today. And Jan, thank you for having us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, that I'm, you know, part of this podcast today. It's a great honor, and it's I look forward to this session. Yeah, I'm Jan-Philipp Schmitz, as you introduced me, with Adyen for almost 20 years now.
Wow.
And I look forward to speaking about Adyen, about my role, you know, describing these different roles that you just mentioned, because indeed they're quite diverse, but therefore very interesting, because you get insights into different parts of the business. So that's very nice.
Yeah. And before we speak about your roles and all your responsibilities, everybody who's close to the industry, of course, knows Adyen as one of the giant players in this space. But maybe you can tell us a little bit about Adyen, because you have a very interesting history, right? Coming as a management buyout from AXA. So can you talk briefly about who Adyen is, where you come from, and what's the main business areas you're focusing on today?
Sure, with pleasure. So, you know, indeed, we spun off roughly 12 years ago in 2013. Before that, we were called AXA Private Equity, and we rebranded into Adyen. So the roots, you know, the origins really date back to 1996. That's when AXA Private Equity was created as part of the insurance group. And what was different than most other insurance private equity or alternative houses was that we had always raised or invested capital from outside the insurance group. And that's why when we spun off in 2013 on very amicable terms, you know, we had the opportunity to do so, because we had this, you know, third party business already. And since then, we've grown strongly. Today, we manage roughly $192 billion US dollars. And we manage that in many different fields. We see ourselves as one of the largest alternative investment houses. And roughly half of the assets under management are in private equity. And private equity, we divide into, on one hand, secondaries, where we are one of the largest, maybe the largest player in globally. We've raised a $30 billion fund earlier this year. We closed it.
Say this again.
$30 billion. That's 30.
That's an amazing number. That's an amazing number.
It's a nice big round number there. And at the same time, you know, we have on the private equity side a different funds, let's say, from small cap to mid cap to even lower large cap, let's say, where, you know, we invest in direct companies predominantly in Europe, but also to some extent in the Americas. And then also the second very large pillar is real assets. You're a sizable player in infrastructure, and we will soon announce a new large fundraising that we did on the direct side. So infrastructure direct, but also real estate. And then the third pillar is private credit. where we're also active since 2005. So it gives you the whole range, let's say, of alternatives. And therefore, it's a very interesting space to be in and having all that oversight. Yeah.
Very good. So let's pick one and start from there. Right? Where do you see the biggest opportunities? And let's start from that domain.
I think we're lucky in a way that, and that's a bit market view also, that there should be a lot of growth going forward in secondaries and in infrastructure. And these are our two largest pillars. And we see a lot of growth in secondaries because, I mean, currently there's a bit less liquidity in the underlying private equity world. As we all know, you know, the M&A volume or IPO volume is a little lower than before. And that helps, of course, the secondaries business, because many large investors are saying, well, I have my allocation to private equity. I'm at my target rate or my target allocation. And then they rather sell 10 or 20% en bloc, let's say, in the secondary space. So there is a lot of growth there. Infrastructure, I think, you know, we maybe, especially in Germany, you know, where there's a huge multi-hundred billion program where infrastructure should be renewed, we're sensitive to it. But it's, of course, a global phenomenon where there's a lot of capital needed for infrastructure. And we have this direct infrastructure fund, which is going to be sizable. You know, we announced it in October. But we're also active in the clean energy space, but also in hydrogen and other subsectors of it. So we want to be part of that whole energy transition. So that's a lot of growth, you know. That's, let's say, for the industry, and therefore there should also be a lot of growth for Ardian. If we look at Ardian itself, and that's a bit also the role that I have, you know, looking at the whole company, how can we grow? It is very much saying, grow all your current flagship funds, the ones that I just mentioned, but also direct private equity buyout, also direct private credit that we do, and make sure that you're really strong in those and deliver good returns and grow these funds every 4 or 5 years by 30, 50, 70% or so. So that's one area of growth for the firm. The other is adjacencies. We call them adjacencies. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. In secondaries, private equity secondaries, we'd grown to a 30 billion fund. Infrastructure secondaries is something younger, where you're buying secondaries in the infrastructure space. We had started 8, 9 years ago with a 500 million fund and then tripled that to 1.7 billion and again tripled to 5 billion in two generations. And it shows you there can be a lot of growth if you go into certain adjacencies. It's something that you know already how to do in secondaries. And these adjacencies we could also have in private credit or in real estate, where we're in one or two sectors, but it can be expanded. So that's, you know, to your question on growth, you know, focus on your key products, make sure that they're really good and strong, but at the same time, look at new growth areas. They will not all grow and they will not all scale as you hope, but that's an interesting way to grow, we think.
Very good. So I have one more question. I know Gori has lined up probably 10 different questions. Yeah. So you have French origins, but you're a global company.
Totally.
Tell us a bit about your global operations.
Sure. So indeed, I mean, the majority of employees now is outside of France. I mean, we have 20 offices today and a truly global house, especially if you look at, you know, where does the capital come from? Who are our investors? Who support us? And that is also the majority today outside of Europe. Yes, Europe, the European investors are still, you know, between 40 and 50% because that's where we came from. And in Europe, you would have, you know, insurance groups from Germany, from France, from the Nordics, from England, from et cetera. But more than 50% of the capital today comes from investors in the Americas, North America, Latin America. A huge growth we are seeing from investors in, let's say, newer regions like Asia and the Middle East. Really, really huge. And that's, let's say, on the fundraising side, client side. But also on the investing side, of course, that's important. Where are we? Yes, on the direct side, that means direct buyout, direct infrastructure, direct private credit. It is still more Europe than the rest of the world. But for example, in secondaries, where we are a very large player, as we said before, the majority of investments is outside of Europe, but mostly North America, which makes sense because it is the biggest market for finance, the biggest capital market, also the biggest alternative market. So, you know, 60% plus of our assets are in predominantly the United States, a bit of other North America.
Yeah, we, of course, private equity and investment as an industry has its own language, right? Mm. So not all of our listeners are familiar with all these wordings. So maybe very quick, what is the primary and what is the secondary?
That's a good question. And, you know, it took me some time 20 years ago to exactly know what's the difference between secondary, primary and direct.
Yes.
So the secondaries and primaries is when you're in a way one level above the direct fund. So most of our capital is in secondaries. In secondaries, you're buying stakes in funds usually mm-hmm. or portfolio companies in the secondary market. So an investor will sell that to you. Okay.
Yep.
So it's more like fund of fund in a way.
Yeah.
Primaries and secondaries. Primaries is if you give capital to a fund that is at the beginning of its fundraising. There's dozens of funds out there. Many of our peers, we work with them, you know, the big US private equity fund managers, the big European fund managers. We give them capital when they raise a fund. So we give them primary capital.
Yeah.
So primary and secondary is really more a fund of fund business.
Yeah.
And then we differentiate to the direct business mm-hmm. where, you know, you raise capital and you invest into the company or into an infrastructure company or an infrastructure asset, or you do the private credit, but there you really go directly into the company. And we do both. I think that's a big part of the interesting perspective in the job that you see almost everything. I mean, you really sometimes go very deep into one company, you majority own it.
Yep.
At the same time, through our secondaries and primaries business, we see the industry, you know, we're invested in more than 1,600 companies. There's more than 10,000 portfolio companies in our database. I would say there's very few parties globally that have that kind of oversight.
Yeah. Because in an overall view, we know that it is around about $180 billion of transaction volume in secondaries.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing large market, right?
Right.
And you are, as you said in the beginning, you're basically the market leader in mm-hmm. this space. I think it's a very interesting topic because there's also some controversial discussion around secondaries. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about this secondary business.
Sure.
Can you give us an overview how you operate in this,
of course,
in this space?
Of course. And, you know, you stated a number on volume. The last 2 years, 23 and 24, and almost all the years before, had constant record volumes.
Mm-hmm.
Most other industries in the alternative space have had 1 or 2 or 3 years of, you know, less volume.
Yeah,
you know, so it just shows you indeed that interest for the asset class. But it's still only 2 or 2.5% of secondary volume is trading of what is on the books, on the balance sheets of big institutional clients like pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, yeah. insurance groups. So it is tiny. The secondary market, of course, on the stock market
yeah.
is more than 100% of the primary market. It's a multiple of it.
Yeah.
And it shows you just that I feel we're still only scratching the surface and, yeah. and there will be much, much, much more growth. I think it could go to 3, 4, 5% or 10%. That's one factor. The other factor is, of course, there's still money being raised. So the volume, the paper, let's say, or the normal amount of volume on the balance sheets is growing. So if these two numbers, the percentage and that grow, there's much more growth in the future. And I think it is, you know, we're providing liquidity in a market that normally is illiquid. You know, you always said, well, there, you know, private equity or private infrastructure, or, you know, you invest, but you're tied in that fund for 10, 12 years.
Yeah.
And the industry started in the 1990s. Our first fund, I think it was 220 million.
Okay.
You see the growth to 30 billion.
Wow. Yeah.
Was in 1998. You know,
Quantum so. Lab.
Yeah. You know, so it shows you know, how the industry grows. So I really feel the industry values it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Both the clients who've invested into it, the limited partners, because they say, hey, there is liquidity. Yes, there's going to be some kind of discount, but they've still done pretty good, decent returns over the, you know, years that they've invested into it. But also the general partners, the private equity fund managers like it because there is liquidity. It means sometimes they can raise new funds afterwards. And one other definition mm-hmm. to make that clear, the 180 billion, historically, it was mostly LP portfolios. There's a differentiation yeah. between LP portfolios and GP-led transactions. So the LP portfolios are classic when the LP, the limited partner, the investor is selling. Let's say insurance A or pension fund B has 10 billion of private equity on its balance sheet and say, hey, I'm going to sell 1 billion, 20 funds, 200 companies, just say, okay, then we would buy into that. That's a classic LP portfolio. In recent years, the GP-led side of the market has definitely grown quite strongly. And maybe there were one or two controversies because of, you know, continuation vehicle or so, if you're referring to that. Although I also think, you know, that just offers liquidity. Nobody has to sell. If you want to stay, you roll over. That's fine, you know. But just to give you these two definitions, these 180 billion almost are now 50-50 between LP portfolios and GP-led portfolios, okay?
Yeah.
But it's really like in every other industry, you know, every asset class, every, you know, even the car industry or whatever. I mean, there's a secondary market for everything and it just provides liquidity. Nobody's forced to sell, but it offers a way out if you want.
Yeah, I like the reference to a second market for cars. I'm an operations guy, as you know, Jan, and I'm working a lot on the performance of companies, right? And my question is, where is the magic trick here with the secondaries? Is it because somebody needs to sell and you get it for a good price? Is it that you see something that is in this investment that is later to come?
Yeah.
So what's the magic trick?
The magic trick, I think, is really understanding what you're buying into. Yes, discount is nice.
Yep.
And I'd always buy a portfolio, if everything's the same, I'd rather buy it for a bigger discount than not. But having said that, I prefer to buy a top quality portfolio at book value.
Okay.
Or even a premium, although we don't buy that. But just to give you the mentality behind it, our job is, and we have a team of 120 professionals with 30 managing directors, senior managing directors, partners who've seen cycles, who know the industry very well, who know the underlying portfolio companies. And our job is to really dig deep into these private assets. And you need to be invested into those assets. You cannot buy the information like in a public market, Bloomberg or Reuters or whatever. You cannot get the data. So that is our job. You know, what's the magic trick? Having an intimate knowledge about these hundreds and hundreds of funds, thousands and thousands of companies. We have a team, as I said, which is huge. And we do the job every quarter. You get a report from the underlying private equity fund manager. And then it is the job of the team that covers this fund, from senior person, partner, managing director, to analyst, to understand, okay, this is the value today. I meet the general partner. I meet this underlying fund manager. And he tells me, company A, B, C, D, and so on, this is our current expectation. This is sales, EBITDA, net debt. This is the exit value that we think it will have, the enterprise value, the EBITDA multiple.
Yeah.
And that's our assumption. And then we need to, when a portfolio, let's say, hits our desk from a seller or an intermediary, we've done the work already. And we then can very quickly in 1, 2, 3 days assemble, let's say, the fund composition that we're offered. We have that in our database. And then we put a price. Is it 5%? Is it 10%? Is it 15% discount? But just to say, the magic trick is, I mean, ultimately, there are three value creation drivers. It is the book value, or we call it NAV, net asset value.
Yep.
That you're buying, and what's your NAV, the net asset value that you expect over the next 5, 6, 7 years, your hundreds of companies, what will it be? And here is really to make sure we buy, we cherry pick good quality portfolios. By the way, almost always, we don't take the portfolio that's offered, but we say we take fund A, we take fund C, we only take 50% of fund D, but we still make it a big portfolio. So that's the predominant value driver, the magic trick, as you call it. And then yes, discount is of course nice. But that's maybe 10, 20, 25% of the value creation, let's say. And the third is some kind of structuring. You know, sometimes we negotiate vendor loans or deferred payments. Oh. So the seller is saying, hey, this is my portfolio. Instead of paying the purchase price now, all of it, maybe you pay me 50% now and 50% in 2 years or so. That helps returns, of course, to narrow the gap. So that's quite interesting there. But it's very important to have all the data and to understand your portfolio. And one other thing I would add, where Ardyn differentiates versus most of our peers, we do very large transactions. We're a solution provider. I've seen if there's portfolios of 1, 2, 3, 400 million in the market, there's huge competition. There could be 30 buyers. If it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 billion portfolio, which we've done, there's only 2 or 3. So that eliminates competition. And that really helps us also.
Okay, great. So I have a question that's more about the general business model.
Right? Yeah.
So because, you know, I'm just trying to think about alternative investment house as a conglomerate.
Yeah.
And conglomerates have a ton of advantages, but also disadvantages. What would you say some of the challenges of running such a diversified investment house?
That's a good question, because we constantly think about that ourselves. You know, how do we make sure that we stay agile, that we stay entrepreneurial, that we move quickly? But yeah, you at the same time need to install some kind of, you know, guardrails, let's say, controls. With $192 billion assets under management, we are amongst the 2-3 largest European rooted houses and amongst the top 10 globally. So we are sizable. At the same time, comparing that to some other asset managers or banking institutions, we're still small. You know, we're 1,100 people. I think when I started, it was less than 100. So yes, we've grown a lot, but still, you know, compared to many other corporates in the corporate classic world or banking financial industry, it's still manageable. But you're totally right that this is something, you know, you want to make sure that it's not too hierarchic. You want to make sure that you can take decisions quickly. I mean, if we do investments, for example, every Wednesday we have an investment committee in private equity, infrastructure, secondaries. I mean, private equity, secondaries, and direct for all the asset classes. So there we can be quick. And if something would have to be very urgent, we've done that also. You know, and in 24 hours we send an email to everybody and we take a decision, because it was discussed already, of course, before. It's a file that maybe has been discussed 2 or 3 months. So we don't want to lose that agility, entrepreneurial spirit, I think. But also, how do you grow? I think growth, as in every industry and every company, is important. We shortly touched it at the beginning. You know, core flagship funds, raise them, be successful in investing them and raising them, adjacencies. But also we think, where are fields that you still want to be in certain geographies, for example, that we're not yet that active as a European rooted house, but also many other asset classes, you know, where we said adjacencies, build them ourselves, but we could maybe also buy them, you know. So that's also another way. And coming back to the root of your question, how do we make sure? I mean, you need to instill that also in the culture, you know, that there's quick decisions, there's trust amongst us, there's transparency, all of that. And then I think it works well, but so it's
kind of decentralized and empowered model.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So, since you are one of the top 10 globally, and, I'm kind of curious about the benefits of going public, cause you're still private,
right?
So, cause some of the top 10 companies out there are actually public.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you're totally right. I think, you know, we're one of the few of the top 10 that is not yet public. So it's a fair question, let's say. And we discussed it, of course, also amongst us repeatedly. I think there are benefits to being public. I mean, you know, liquidity, for example, for shareholders of the firm. And by the way, Ardian, the majority of employees are shareholders. That's quite a nice model. Also, you know, to staying entrepreneurial, by the way, to the point before, you know, everybody has a common goal to grow the company, to make sure that checks and balances are there. So there are definitely these benefits, you know, if you do an IPO, maybe that worked as a private company when you're relatively small, but now we've grown quite a bit. So that's an advantage. Another advantage could be that as you grow, also in the private wealth space, your brand is a bit more known and public. And that's also a reason why some of our peers have done that. At the same time, it could also have some more administrative burdens, as you very well know, you know, from very regular reporting. And you're public. I mean, just being there, it could have advantages and disadvantages being an acquirer or being acquired, you know. So we balance these pros and cons. I mean, so far, I really feel that we're perfect the way we are, i.e. as a private company. Also, many of our large LPs, i.e. our large investors, limited partners, they like the fact that we're private, that we really focus on investing, on portfolio work, on exiting the companies and being close to our investors, than maybe having too much focus on all that public side of the world. So, you know, but we see the pros and cons, and, you know, let's see what the future will bring. It's nothing imminent, I can promise you that. But let's see. I mean, I wouldn't rule it out for the mid to long term. Yeah.
There is one thing that we see coming from consulting, is that especially if you go public, to keep this entrepreneurial spirit, right? This strong performance orientation in this setup is very difficult.
Yeah.
So everybody is challenged by this. Some keep it very good, like one of your it's not a competitor, one of you, of the others, EQT.
Yeah.
They went public, right? And they have, of course, maintained this kind of mindset, but it's not that easy, right?
For sure. I will totally agree with you.
All right. So let's then talk about energy and infrastructure.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned that is an area of you know, promise.
Yeah.
Right? So in the beginning. And so what are you doing there? Yeah. How excited are you about that field?
Yeah.
And you mentioned the fund coming up as well.
So we have been active in the direct infrastructure side since almost also 20 years, actually 2005. So it is 20 years. And currently we're raising that sixth generation and we will announce the closing soon. But it's going to be sizable. I cannot say more at this stage because we're also just fine-tuning the final numbers. But it's going to be very sizable. And so one of the market leaders globally, certainly in Europe, but globally. At the same time, we've done investments and raised capital for, let's say, dedicated clean energy funds. So, you know, anything that's renewable from solar to wind to biomass and so on. We've also raised a dedicated hydrogen fund 2-3 years ago of 2 billion euros that was in the press, making it, I think, almost the largest or one of the largest dedicated pockets for hydrogen, just to show you, you know, we're trying to cover the whole range. The flagship fund here, and but this is one that's mostly focused in Europe. We also have a mid-sized fund for the Americas. Just yesterday, we sold a company, so it was in the press in the energy production to one of our large US peers in Pennsylvania. So we're also active in the Americas. But in Europe, we really focus on energy transition. We focus on transport. We've been owners of some of the well-known airports. For example, we're the largest shareholder in Heathrow. We had once owned the two Milano airports, Malpensa and Linate. We'd sold those recently. We also owned one of the airports around London. We're looking at another airport. I'm just saying that because people can relate to airports. You know, almost everybody has been in Heathrow, even if the lines are a bit long sometimes. You know, I still have to stay in those lines too, by the way. You know, but that's maybe 10 or 15% of our investments. The majority, as I said, you know, energy transition, but also digital infrastructure, cable. We've bought into telco towers. So yeah, we're in all that space, and the team has really done a good job delivering good returns and working with many either corporates or entrepreneurs, making us one of the leaders globally, especially in Europe.
Are you investing in data centers?
Yes, we have invested in one company in Europe called Verne. 2 years ago. It's also part of that newest infrastructure fund six. And the company has the data centers mostly in Northern Europe, so Nordics, England, which is inherently good in a way because it's not that warm there. And data centers have a lot of, create a lot of heat and energy. So, but yeah, it is a great investment. It's done very well. But, you know, we don't have a dedicated, let's say, data center fund just for that. We want to diversify a little bit. In infrastructure, I think it's important to diversify both in terms of geography, but also in terms of sectors, because there could be changes in regulation, there could be changes in business models, and you want to make sure that you're not just too much focused into one thing, because then you could, you know, could end up badly.
Yeah. Maybe one switch looking at your business into the geographics, right? So the world is in a difficult state. We are all sure about this. And so my question is, you have a European footprint when it comes to your investors, when it comes to your investments. And at the same time, you act very global, right? So my question is, especially also looking at Asia, because it's also your responsibility, how do you look at Asia and how do you look at the world and the difficulties that we see? Yeah. How is it affecting you in your business acting?
Yeah, it's an important topic indeed. I mean, the world is definitely a different place than 2, 3, 4 years ago. And it's still moving, you know, we're watching, you know, things changing. What we see is that quite a few investors like us as a European house, you know, some Asian LPs, they're, you know, reducing a little bit the US exposure. Uh-huh. So that I think helps us. What also helps us is that we are a player in the field that is multi-local. I mean, we have 20 offices, as I said before, you know, so you really want to be in these different markets on the ground, speaking closely to your different stakeholders. That could be investors, but it could be, you know, entrepreneurs that sell your company, the companies to you, or in infrastructure assets, the regulator, all of that. So that definitely helps us. I would also say that given that we are so global, we can always adapt a little bit to the situation, you know, invest a little bit more there.
Yeah.
On the fundraising front, and I can speak about it quite well because I lead that, I think it's been the last 3 years were record volumes that we've always raised. Mm. And if you're just, let's say, fully focused on Europe or fully in the United States, even I give an example in 2021, 22, post COVID, many US pension funds were over allocated into private equity or private infrastructure because not much exits were happening and stock markets went down a little bit. We call it the denominator effect. And suddenly they were over allocated. They couldn't invest. So even if you're one of the top two, three global market leaders and 80% of your investor base was American, you really had to pivot away quickly. And we always had that advantage that we said, we have 20 offices. Mm-hmm. We raise capital from everywhere. And that's the fundraising side, but also from the investing side, having these multiple local footprints has really helped us. And I give you another example. We have a fund in semiconductor. In today's market, there are clients that see there is really value added if you're a European player, because everybody wants to be somewhat independent in today's market. You know, the US is, of course, formidable and strong. The Chinese are similarly very, very successful. But saying, hey, we need to do something here also in Europe. So we've raised that capital, by the way, mostly outside of Europe capital. Mm-hmm. But to invest in the whole semiconductor universe, let's say, it could be many different companies, but in Europe, where we have top-notch research, you know, in Germany, the Fraunhofer Institute, but many others in France, in Belgium, and so on. And so it shows you it's not all bad with the world that is definitely very much moving. I think, yeah, we've had three record years and there's advantages, opportunities, let's say, also to have from that.
That's good to hear that you still believe in Europe, right? Because Absolutely. There's a lot of talk about how far Europe is behind, right? Especially when it comes to the technology sector, et cetera. So it's good to know that you see the investment opportunities in technology also in Europe.
No, right? For sure. Yeah. Totally.
Maybe coming to the private equity business, mm-hmm. Because our podcast is called Corporate.
Right.
Transformation, right? Leading corporate transformation. So let me start with a quick quote from Henry Kravis from KKR. Mm-hmm. He said, private equity is making the corporate world more responsible and management act like owners, right? Mm-hmm. That's what he said. So my question is, what's your strategy on the private equity, also primaries and direct investments and where you say is the responsibility of the management of these companies?
Yeah, there is definitely... The management is automatically more of a shareholder because they own a larger share than a classic CEO of a publicly traded company. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's therefore I would agree to that to that saying, and also the focus of a private equity firm that is owned by a private equity fund ownership, mm-hmm. as you know, usually the holding periods are on average 5 years. Could be 3 or 4 years, but it could be 6 or 7, let's say 5 years. So in these 5 years, you need to create value.
Yeah.
And usually there's a 100-day business plan, you know, you need to implement that. Now, does it always go perfectly well? No, but the majority of transactions it does, and that shows in the numbers. And of course it is different if you own 60, 70, 80% of a company and the management maybe owns 10%. And we at Ardian, by the way, we've always, if there was a successful exit, we've even given more than what was initially agreed to the senior management, but tried to give it to all the employees, like an extra bonus.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you will work with a new entrepreneur in the future, a new management team, they will call the companies that you worked with in the past. Like, how were they as owner? Yeah. You know, are they fair people? You know, are they? And, you know, that helps. And we were almost, I think, we did it more than 15 years ago already. And that motivates the people. Mm-hmm. But just comparing the two business model, if you own, let's say you're one of the big asset managers or hedge fund, you know, you own 2 or 3%. Yes, you can send letters and you can try to get 10 or 15% or 20% of the votes behind you.
Yeah.
But just owning 60, 70%, 80% and management 10% or so, that's a very different alignment and very Absolutely. Different decision making in good and in bad times, by the way. In good times, you very clearly say these are the growth areas we want to go into, geographies, products, etc. At the same time, if things are not that great, which can happen in difficult macro times, but also if there's a disruption to your business model, you can also quicker adapt. You know, sometimes that has to happen too, unfortunately, but that's business life, you know.
Okay, so I want to bring up a nasty word, namely bubble.
Because
I think we found the right person to ask this question. Where do you see a bubble?
Well, I don't see it that much in the private world. I might be a little bit biased here, but no. Look, I mean, the majority of companies are in the private world, the vast majority of companies. So the field of investments is huge, you know. So private equity, I don't really see it. I mean, yes, the industry currently has a bit of an overhang from lots of investments in maybe 2020, 2021, when they're, or even before, when the interest rates were, of course, very low. And then a lot of capital flooded the market from central banks, government subsidies, whatever, during COVID. But overall, I think, you know, that will level each other out or level it out. So that should be okay. Yes, some companies are very large, so they have to find their way out. You know, the IPO window was a little difficult in the past years, but we're seeing some silver linings, let's say, light at the end of the tunnel. There is a couple of large, like 10, 20 billion IPOs just lined up in the United States. So one thing is the deal side on private equity. So, you know, that I just mentioned, more is in the private space than the public space. Also, if you speak to clients, the majority of clients wants to rather increase their allocation alternatives because they say the returns have actually, on average, been a little bit better than public markets, but there's less volatility. And so on one hand, I think there's still a lot of great opportunities to buy into, but also capital from the institutional clients, but also private wealth is going into it. So I think that's important to understand. And then you could discuss, you know, infrastructure. I think there's still a lot of need. Private credit, you know, some people speak about that, but I also think if you have a good manager that has done this since 20 years or 30 years, even gone through cycles, you should be in safe hands. So, and last comment, comparing it a little bit to the public market, look at the S&P 500. That was driven, as we all know, by handful, you know, Magnificent Seven, was it five companies, yeah. 10 that sometimes switches a little bit, but you have a large exposure or a big driver of the value has been these couple of companies. So yes, AI has been great. There's a lot of spending, but you have a bit of risk there too. That's what I'm just trying to say, you know. So, and to have a broad diversified private equity portfolio or private alternative and portfolio in general, I think is very low risk. And we've seen that doing it since the 1990s. No fund has ever lost capital, no Ardian fund ever. And also, you know, for example, in secondaries, I think the industry has never been below 10%. You will also not do three times cost, you know, but yeah. But if you diversify well, it's a very low risk asset class for me.
Great. Since you mentioned AI, we have to ask a question about it as well, right? So of course, right?
Of course.
How is AI transforming your processes? And if you were to give an advice to next generation young Philipp Schmitz, what would you say with respect to AI?
Yeah. So AI is of course a big transformational force in our everyday life, as we all know. In the financial world, private equity world, it's also starting to be seen. What I mean with it is, I mean, any investment decision will still be taken by humans. And I think that's still going to be the case for the foreseeable future. You know, you have that certain knowledge. But where it helps us a lot is analyzing data, summarizing a trove of data that we have. And that's, in fact, the case for the one side of our business, which is secondaries, you know, where we're more than 10,000 portfolio companies, but also on the direct side, you know, it could even help us in legal contracts, SPAs, you know,
of course
they go through it. I mean, of course we have our law firms, we have in-house legal team. Don't get me wrong here, but also it helps them and it helps us, you know, so in negotiations, in preparing investment memoranda, but very important to state the point that every document or every investment decision would be overseen by a human, but it just helps us a lot to do the groundwork, let's say, of certain investment cases. Also to source transactions in certain sectors, you know, in certain geographies and so definitely it helps here. And what is my recommendation? I mean, I would say if you're young, you want to go into the industry, you know, make yourself knowledgeable about AI. You know, it's a fast evolving market. Again, I believe that humans will still take final decisions for a long, long time, but to use them as tools is very, very interesting.
So that basically means, if I'm allowed to summarize it, if you look, the entrepreneurial spirit, this keeps human. So which basically translates into AI is not going to replace you overall, but it's going
I
to...
I hope not, but...
but it's like investors using AI very smart are going to be the winners in the market.
I would agree to that. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, you have to use it. I mean, for example, on the infrastructure side, we have other software that shows how much emissions are used by a certain airport, airlines, and so on. So there's a lot of tools that, that you can use to make, to get better data, and then on based on this data, take certain decisions. Or all our renewable wind parks or solar, you know, there's a lot of automated processes and AI then summarizes that. So there's a lot of help. And obviously, I believe, you know, much more to come there still.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, great. I wish we had another hour. Unfortunately, we don't. But I still want to know a bit more about your own background and personality.
Sure.
And what do you think has made you successful in this business?
What has made me successful? That's a good question. And I sometimes look back, you know, on the past 20 years. And I think one thing that was key is that I liked the business. I thought it was interesting. And that's also a key recommendation for any student or, you know, not just in finance or for VHU, but for everyone, try to choose a job that really interests you because you will spend a lot of time in that job. And yes, sometimes I wake up on a Monday morning, I think, oh, well, it's not like every day is shiny and rosy, but I mean, I still, you know, on most of the days, the vast majority of days, I really love the job. I love to, you know, work on a secondary transaction. I love to work, to see clients, to win clients, to work in a great team, you know, and reach goals and you know, surpass challenges. So that's great. So I would say that was one key point. And otherwise, sometimes, you have to work hard. I think, you know, there is no way around it. At the same time, try to look at your work-life balance to some extent, you know, on the weekends and, you know, see what makes you grounded and calm at the same time. But yeah, those are important factors, I would say. I would also add a bit of luck sometimes helps, being at the right place with the right people. But always when I got these opportunities, you know, I went for it confidently, but also asking for advice. You know, never be afraid of asking for advice. I still ask for advice now in my position all the time. You need to constantly keep learning in today's time more than ever. So, you know, ask questions. They're almost never stupid questions, you know. So I think that's also... I think an advice and what helped me. Yeah.
You said working a lot is part of the game, but can you give us a little bit of an like insight in your week? Because as we said in the beginning, so you're responsible, your responsibilities sit in Europe and also in Asia.
Yeah.
What does it mean? How do you divide your time and how often are you present?
Yeah.
And I think you are going to open up an office in Hong Kong very soon. So this will for sure bring you there again. So let us have a little bit of an insight into your daily life.
Yeah. And you know, on that, I was in New York last week and in Singapore the week before. Now I'm for 1 week in Frankfurt. That's hardly ever happens. Actually, no, tomorrow I travel to another city, but to be in Germany for 1 week, that doesn't happen often. But, you know, on a classical day for me, and I would divide it almost 50-50 being on the road. I mean, I'm covering the global client relationship. Yeah. So the clients want to see me. My teams in Asia want to see me. Sometimes my colleagues in the United States want to see me. But so I would divide it roughly 50-50 traveling and being at the office. When I travel, of course, you travel often far away or in Europe, or, you know, you meet clients. You have a couple of client meetings. Sometimes it can be very packed. I've had 5-6 meetings, 7 sometimes a day, which then starts to be heavy. And you wonder, what did I say in the first meeting? Did I just say that? But usually, let's say a couple of meetings, a lunch or dinner, that's when I'm traveling. When I'm here, I come to the office, you know, it depends. I mean, it's a bit more flexible with all our digital devices that we have today, but I try to be at the office, let's say at 9 o'clock. I try to do a bit of sport in the morning that grounds me, balances me. I think that's in the last few years, I've really learned that as an important factor of well-being. I have a big family, many kids, but you know.
How many?
6.
Wow.
So that keeps me busy too, you know, but that shows you then during the day here, if I'm at the office, you know, in the first years, so also for the younger generation, yes, I've done long hours, you know, 10, 11, 12 sometimes. But I think we as an organization, and certainly for me, I try to then rather go home, still see the kids or the family, have dinner with them. Sometimes you can still work, of course, afterwards. You have your emails, your iPad, your iPhone. You can do calls. So trying to break that up a little bit. So when I'm here, I really try to also take care for myself, take care for the family, take care, you know, for friends. I think that's important. But in a way, you're almost always on, but sometimes I will just turn off the phone or something. But that works quite well. I can work quite well with this, let's say, dual, you know, being at the office, of course, constantly on, but also at home, then sometimes more, sometimes less in the evenings or even on the weekends. But it's okay. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Then I have one more question and then I'll hand over to Gori for closing. And the question is this: where do you see the role of Frankfurt going forward? Because we happen to be in Frankfurt.
Oh, interesting.
City that I live in. Yeah, of course. I'm a big fan of Frankfurt.
Yes, I think, I like that.
and I'm always curious from a, you know, from an expert point of view,
no, within
the banking and finance in the bigger sense.
That's, we discussed that in the organization. I mean, Frankfurt, for us at Ardian, we're like 80 people here. That's one of the 2-3 largest representations of any firm, either international firm or German firm or European firm or whatever. So for us, the Frankfurt office has a really important role. I would also add, I mean, it has an important role from two perspectives: investments, and we've been investing here since 20 years or so, in direct private equity, direct credit. We own a large infrastructure portfolio company, EWE, which is one of the big Versorger, you know, one of the big energy companies in Germany. Real estate. So we invest in every space. But interestingly, the German client base is amongst the one or two largest for Ardian. That's quite interesting, you know. So the majority of German insurance groups or pension funds or Versorgungswerke, as we call them, you know, liberal professions like the doctors and lawyers. There's a big, big community of German LPs. So for us, therefore, the Frankfurt office has always been very important. It's not far from WHU, and we do have some really good, talented employees. You know, our head of real estate, interestingly, for example, is also an ex-alumni from the WHU and some others too. But now the big question is what will be the future? I think, and I've been speaking to politicians, I've been speaking to other people, senior people in the financial world. I mean, there is a lot of energy, or, you know, their goals to make the Finanzplatz Frankfurt, let's say, bigger and more relevant. I think a lot will also depend on more integration in Europe. And then I think as largest economy, Germany should always play an important role, let's say, with, you know, a big still Mittelstand and a lot of corporate world. And so I'm, you know, while I think we all agree it's not the size of London or Paris, for example, I think there is a lot of things speak for Frankfurt. And interestingly, maybe as a last comment, I've been speaking to many people who came from abroad, like yourself also, but they said, once you're here, it's actually very nice. You know, it is quite practical. The ways are not too far, and then people like it. And therefore, yeah, it's a good place to be. I myself, that's my last comment now on that point. But I myself, of course, have constantly been thinking, you know, do you maybe go to Paris, or do you go to London or New York, or we have a beautiful office in Zurich at the Bahnhofstrasse. I mean, there's many places you could, or London could have gone, but I've seen all the advantages here, and having one of the most senior positions in this organization, you know, it hasn't been a negative for my career, but also I can do the job from here easily, like in any other of the big cities. So that's good.
Yeah. As you said, you have one of the most important jobs in this company. And of course, coming from PwC, there's a question I need to ask before we really close. And it's about, you have a Big Four background starting off your career in the Big Four industry. Yeah. How important was it that you started there? And would you recommend it to the young listeners to start in our industry before moving
forward? Totally. And that's also a recommendation I give to young, talented people. Despite what I said before, you know, that you choose a job that interests you and so on, but we usually hire from three industries. One is, you know, the Big Four, or like accounting firms, or in the transaction services business in there. Ideally have also advised some private equity clients. It is nitty gritty.
Yep.
And, you know, but you learn the basics, you know, you learn about a balance sheet, how it works. You learn about the P&L of a company, the cash flow. And so you get a good education
Yep.
Gutes Grundhandwerk, as we like to say in Germany. So that's good. The other two sectors, as you won't be surprised, are either investment banks or consulting firms, you know, strategy consultants or other consultants for certain sectors. And that's what we like. So also as a recommendation for any listener who wants to go into the industry, try to do internships either in these three industries or ideally already with a couple of private equity firms directly. Mm-hmm. And then you see sometimes they take you right after university, right after you did your studies. Or sometimes they ask you, we've done both at Ardian, sometimes they ask you to first do a two or three year, or the position is not open that moment, then you pivot into one of these industries and later you could come back. So
listeners, listen well, right? There is an important layer in consulting and in the Big Four business.
Totally.
Yes. So we could speak for, I would say, another 10 hours.
True.
Very interesting.
I enjoyed it.
Ardian is very interesting. Your own career is very interesting. So, but we need to come to an end, right, Zerdan? Like always, too bad. But we have a final question, and that's a classic. It's our classic question. Because we really like to get some ideas of what keeps you maybe awake at night when it comes to, do you listen to a certain podcast? Do you read a book at the moment that really drives you? Is there a certain movie that had an impact on you? So what do you have in sitting on your cupboard?
Yeah. I mean, to the first part of the question, what keeps me awake at night? Fortunately, I sleep pretty well. And as a firm, we're doing really well, I would say. You know, of course, you constantly think, what could you maybe change or accelerate growth or the fundraising or investing? But currently, I feel in a very good state of mind, and also with my colleagues in the senior management of Ardian. And that's great. Now, about my, you know, personal interest, or if there's something that I would recommend from a podcast. I mean, the podcast obviously
a source of inspiration.
That's amazing. That is like right up there in the top. That is obvious.
Sure. Yeah.
But I mean, I read a lot every day, mostly newspapers. You know, from international to German. I have 5 or 6 that I have on my iPad, and I read them 10 minutes each every morning, so I have a good view. So I read a lot. Sometimes I don't manage to read too many books because, you know, a couple of hundred pages, you get that done in a summer holiday maybe or so. So, you know, but one book or a couple of books from that author really impressed me because I've always had interest for history. Initially, I wanted to study history. My father gave me that sort of interest in that field. But then I thought, okay, go into finance, maybe a little bit more boring, but in the end, maybe it pays a bit better. And so, you know, like, but just to say, I really enjoyed the first books of Harari, you know, we all know him. And because he summarizes, on one hand, you know, the first one was Sapiens and I think History, looking backwards, and he summarized it so well, I thought. And then also now he's looking more into the current market or the current world.
And the future, right?
And the future, you're totally right. And so I found that always very, very interesting if I would have to pick one. But, you know, I also read, you know, fun books, or if I manage to read, or I sometimes watch movies or series, and, you know, just sometimes to relax and all that too, you know. That's if I would have to pick one, that's something that really interested me.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much again. Thanks, Gori.
That was amazing. Thanks, Jan.
Thank you, gentlemen. It was a big pleasure to be with the two of you. Thank you for your time.
That was Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Otto Beisheim School of Management, powered by PwC. Editorial team, Annika Lux-Rerich and Simon Gerlach.